Legends and lessons. Let us learn a little bit tonight about a very special individual. Perhaps his name is not as familiar to you as he is to me, but he has certainly had a great impact on your life. The person we'll talk about tonight is a man by the name of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Anyone know where Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was? Or the impact he has in your life? Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector is the namesake of Yeshiva University's Smicha program. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was a rabbi, as we'll talk about, in Russia in the 19th century. He ultimately has a Talmud that settles in New York City and ultimately creates a yeshiva for Europeans, even American, first-generation Americans, who become, you know, older and then need their own place, including his son, this rabbi's son. I think his name was Rav Moshe Matlin. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. But he ultimately creates a yeshiva called Eitz Chaim in the Lower East Side. And that yeshiva, you know, the kids get older, they start to create their own yeshiva, and they start a new yeshiva. I don't know if it had a specific name or not, the one when they sort of graduated out of the first one. But that ultimately became what we now know as Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector Theological Seminary. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary, also known as REITS, R-I-E-T-S. So that's who we're talking about tonight, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. You know, I don't know if people are familiar with this, a little yeshivish culture, but it's a little bit of a yeshivish thing to call your yeshiva by your Rebbe's last name. I don't know if people know some yeshivas. I'm not gonna name any, but it's like a thing. Well, I go to so-and-so's yeshiva. You know, they just say the last name. So once I was at an Ofrif for a yeshivish relative, and schmoozing with the guys about yeshiva, about whatever. And he said, oh, where did you go to yeshiva? Where do you go to yeshiva? And I told him, oh, I go to Spector's as a joke, because I thought that would be funny to yeshivish guys. No one got it, except for one of them. He said, do you mean YU? And I said, yes, I mean YU. So that's who we're talking about tonight. We're talking about Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Who was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector? Let's go all the way back to 1817. He's born to a Rav Yisrael Ister. I'm not 100% sure what the deal is with the last names. His father, I think Isser was his last name, I'm not sure. And then his son goes by the name Rabinovich. So I'm not 100% sure if, I mean, in the 1800s, I thought last names were already pretty standard, but it seems like they were still a little flexible. But either way, so he's born to Rabbi Yisrael Isser and Rachel in the town of Grudna. Grudna, not to be confused with Grundy, which is where Rabbi Yonah the Rishon is from. That's in Spain. This is Grudna, which at the time was in Russia, is now in Belarus. Obviously, a lot in the news about what's considered Russia right now, but not for now. Certainly not for now. But either way, so Rabbi Yisrael Ister actually had some Hasidic tendencies, which Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector did not have. At least he wasn't opposed, but he didn't have. He wasn't known as a Hasidish Rebbe in any sense. Like, I think last couple of times we've talked about Hasidish Rebbe, so here's good to sort of go into some litvak. So his father was actually Rav himself of a place called Resh. Resh, not sure how to pronounce it. It's spelled in Hebrew Resh Aleph Shin. So it looks like Rosh, but I think it's pronounced Resh. Either way. As a young child, as this oftentimes happens, he was a genius. He was certainly what they would call an Eloi, a prodigy, and his father was his Rebbe. And ultimately, you know, sort of he grows out of that and is already, I believe actually his father died when he was a child. I couldn't confirm that, but I believe he was orphaned in one way, either his father or his mother. But either way, at the age of 13, he not only got bar mitzvah, but he also got married. I don't think it was the same day, but they could have saved on the bills. But he got married at 13 years old. I'm not sure, maybe it was because of the lack of parents or something, but he basically went and joined his father-in-law's home. Father-in-law, I want to say he was a Rav. No, he was, not 100% sure. but he was in a place called Vilkovsk. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but he marries a woman named Sarah Razel. And he goes and he learns in this place by a rabbi, Binyamin Diskind. Binyamin Diskind was himself a rav who had a yeshiva, and he actually ultimately got smicha from this Rav Binyamin Diskind, and he was chavrusas with Rav Binyamin Diskind's son. Rav Binyamin Diskind's son is much more well-known than his father. That's because he is the Maharil Diskind. The Maharil Diskind, Rav Shul Leib Diskind, was one of the Gedolim also of Russia in those times. So they had what to do with each other. He got smicha there, and he learned by him. But eventually, his father-in-law couldn't support him anymore, and he himself lost all of his money. So at the age of 19 years old, so what's 19 years old? You just graduated high school, maybe you're in college for a year, maybe went to yeshiva for 1 year. At the age of 19, he becomes the Rav of a shul in a place called Zebulun. I think that's how you pronounce it. Zebulun, maybe. In Hebrew, it's a Zion. In English, it's an S. So I don't know which one takes precedence. We have very, very, minimal salary. I saw somewhere that it was barely enough to buy food. And I know that the measurement of the salary was in rubles. I don't know if that means anything to you, but it was like 1 ruble a week or something like that. It was like very, very little. Ultimately, he was too poor to continue supporting his family. At this point, he's married for 8 years. And you can imagine the children getting older. He does have a few different children. He had three sons. Ultimately, he'll have three sons. Not sure exactly what time in his life he had these children. But he had three sons and one daughter. Both the son, one of the sons, Chaim, and one of the daughters, Rachel, actually die while he's alive. So they didn't really succeed him. He had two other sons, Binyamin and Hirsch. Hirsch succeeded him, and Binyamin, I'm not sure what Binyamin did. Either way. So at the age of 22, because of his poverty, he's got to figure out something else. And they move to, I don't know if they move to another plant or another town, or he goes to visit to another town, to be by the Mishkanos Yaakov, another posek in Russia. There's Rav Yaakov Bruchin, or Brushin, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. He's known as the Mishkanos Yaakov. He also has a sefer called the Kilos Yaakov, but you shouldn't call him that because people will think you're talking about a different Kilos Yaakov. Either way, he goes to the Mishkanos Yaakov, and the Mishkanos Yaakov was actually very important for him to sort of to promote his prominence. At this point, he's 22 years old, and he's impressing the Mishkanos Yaakov, so much so that the Mishkanos Yaakov actually sort of gives him a recommendation to go become a Rav in some other place called Barisa. Barisa, also the little towns in Russia here. And so with the help of the Mishkanos Yaakov, he gets there. I think the first job maybe had less than 1 ruble a week. This job was 1 ruble a week, which apparently was better, but not by much. There's some kind of feud that he has over Gittin. Now, Gittin is a very complex situation. I read a couple stories about him with Gittin. Gittin, obviously, as you know, is divorces, right? And there was, I don't know if this was the same case, but there's another case where he has a tshuva about a woman who was swindled into a marriage. The guy pretended like it was a business deal, said the words, Hareyat Mikudeshesli, and then gave the guy money, gave the woman money, something like that. And there's Oshayla, if she was married or not, did she need to get or not? And he paskened that, like, basically, no, didn't need to get at all because it was done under false pretenses. Whatever, I heard a little bit of a shir about it. He later on in life actually is very instrumental in the Aguna situations, which is even more complicated. But either way, here, this is already in 1840, so he's 23 years old, and he makes this psak about a get. I'm not sure exactly what it was. I want to say something, but I did not look at it today, so I don't want to say it. But the point is that he had this this feud, and he ultimately wins out. That the other rabbi sort of admits that he was right. This also adds to his popularity to the extent that in 1846, he may or may not have had to escape. So just sort of to set the stage, we're in the middle of the 19th century in Russia. So it's not the best time for the Jews in Russia. don't know if people are familiar with what's going on there. You have the Pale Settlement. I don't know when that started or when that continued. I think it was a little bit later, but this was the beginnings of it. Ultimately, it starts, you know, pogroms and you know, not necessarily from the government down, but there was a whole, you know, secularization of Russia. There was what the Maskilim. There was a whole kind of culture that was not very kind to Frum Jews. If you remember, Volozhin also, as he'll also join Volozhin later, Volozhin will ultimately be caught up in this sort of feud too. Either way, when he's 29 years old in 1846, he escapes Barisa for a place called Nishvez. And Nishvez, he becomes the Rav. He gets 4 rubles a week. He's really raking in the dough now. 4 rubles a week in this place called Nishvez. But the problem was, he was 29 years old. 29 years old. What is this young whippersnapper coming in here? He thinks he could take a salary of 4 rubles a week. He's 29 years old. What does he know? So first of all, it happens to be it was his fourth shtetl already. He's been a Rav already for 8 years. But either way, he had to prove himself. And ultimately, he was in this place for 5 years. And he certainly did. But he was on to bigger and better things, because he ultimately goes to a place that you might be familiar with called Nevardik. People know Nevardik? Yeah, so Nevardik is one of the 2 main offshoots of the Musar movement. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter starts what's called the Musar movement. Musar obviously existed before that, right? Working on herself and discipline development. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, starts the movement called the Musar movement. And it shoots off into basically 2 categories, at least 2 main ones. There was Slobodka, which is the altar of Slobodka. We've talked about him in a little bit, enough to speak. The altar of Slobodka. Slobodka was sort of like focusing on godless Adam, the greatness of a person, that you should always be held to a high standard. You should dress nicely. You should keep your beard cut short, right? That kind of stuff. You should talk precisely and concisely. And Nevardik was not the opposite, but very different. They focused on what's called Shiflas Adam. Nevardik, which is where he's going. They focus on, I think it was Yosef Horowitz, maybe? I don't exactly remember. I think that he was the altar of Nevardik. But either way, so Yosef Zundel, maybe? So he ends up in Nevardik, which is a place where they focus on, you know, Shiflas Adam, right? It's a place where they consider themselves like nothing. Right, like they're worthless, and they walked around disheveled, and they walked around with not nice clothing, you know, and there are all these legends about how they would go into places just to be embarrassed so that they could feel embarrassment, you know, going to a bakery and asking for nails. They have all these, like, you know, stories about how they were trying to be reprimanded so they could lower themselves, that kind of thing. So that's Nevardik, that's where he goes, but it was a big town, right, to have a big offshoot, not necessarily in the Musar movement, but It was a much bigger place. I'm not sure how many rubles he got for that job. But either way, he becomes a Rav of Nevardik, which was a big deal. Ultimately, it's actually important. I'm not sure, I'm not 100% sure if this is what sort of bred his relationship, but he becomes friends or a mentor to Reb Shmuel Salanter. Reb Shmuel Salanter, I believe, was Reb Yisrael Salanter's son. Reb Shmuel Salanter was very instrumental in creating what's called the Yishuv Hayashan. You know, the Yishuv Hayashan in Yerushalayim, I believe one of the first settlements outside of the confines of the old city, the Yishuv Hayashan. But either way, so Shmuel Salanter was very instrumental there, and he turned towards Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan later in life for guidance and the halachic psak about things that were going on in Eretz Yisrael, because it was really a new thing in the 1800s to set up a Frum settlement in Eretz Yisrael was not a simple thing, and a lot of shilas. So I'm not sure if they connected over Nevardik, but Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's Talmidim go to Nevardik, and Rabbi Yisrael Chanan's Talmidim included Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's son, Shmuel Salanter. So there might have been a connection there, unclear to what extent. That happens when he's the age of 34, right? So he's in Nevardik. I think I saw somewhere, not many sources brought this down. I saw another source that had said that he also was in another place called Zitzmir. No, sorry, Zhemel. He was in a place called Zhemel, but at this point, suffice it to say, he is already a big Rav at this point. He's in Nevardik. Everybody knows, oh, the rabbi from Nevardik. And if I'm not mistaken, the Aruch HaShulchan might take over for him in the Vardik. There's this correspondence, I think I told you about this once, that it's written up in Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein's basically family biography, although it's not really meant for that, called the Makor Baruch, where he talks about how the Aruch HaShulchan, and in past years I've actually talked about, actually I have it here, in past years I've talked about Rav Yitzchak Elkanan and Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, who was the Aruch HaShulchan. I've talked about them sort of in tandem. Let me just see for a second. I don't have it here. Either way, I believe there was a letter that, yeah, but the Aruch HaShulchan took over at Nevardik for the last 34 years of his life after Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan left, right? So the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan is a big, big deal, right? We paskin like the Aruch HaShulchan many times. I quoted him during Mincha Maariv, I quote him a lot, right? So the Aruch HaShulchan, whose yahrzeit is actually the day after Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan, in fact, the 22nd of Adar, not the same year, about 12 years later, but he took over for Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan Spector in the Vardik. Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan Spector once wrote him a letter, coming back to what I was trying to say, once wrote him a letter, praising him or sort of being jealous of him, because he remembered his days in the Vardik. And he said, the days in the Vardik were very simple. I got to learn. I wasn't, the Vardik was a big town, but it wasn't like an overwhelming, minute-to-minute, requests for him. Nevardik was a nice place to live, to learn. The Aruch HaShulchan wrote an entire sefer, a huge sefer. The Aruch HaShulchan is not a small sefer. It's, 20 volumes, at least on our shelf, going through all the Shulchan Aruch and things like that. Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Spector had Sfarim also, but he's most well-known for his Shalos Yeshuvos, the questions that he got and the answers that he got from all over the world. So it wasn't, not the same kind of Sfarim. The Aruch HaShulchan basically, learned all the sugyas, went through all the Shulchan Aruch and wrote commentaries. That's not the same kind of sefer than answering questions for people. One is, dealing with the community and everything. So Yitzchak Elkanan Spector looked back at his days in the Vardik as sort of like, simpler times. But ultimately, his calling was to do, again, bigger and better things. Or bigger and more influential things, I should say. At the age of 40, he becomes the youngest member of the Voloshiner Yeshiva's rabbis. Unclear exactly to what extent he actually worked there. I know, for instance, that he was instrumental in terms of deciding, I think we talked about this last year, maybe when we talked about the Netziv or Rav Chaim Voloshiner, that there was a big dispute about who would become the Rosh Yeshiva. Right? It should be this guy, that guy, someone in the family of Voloshin, of Rav Chaim, or outside of the family, the Netziv, and there was somewhat of a schism. There was a whole court case over it, based on things. And Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Spector was, I believe, part of that decision-making process. Right, so he gets to Voloshin in 1854 or so, 1857 maybe. So at 40 years old, he's taking care of the most prominent yeshiva in Europe and therefore the world. At 40 years old, he's not the only person on the board, but he definitely made obviously enough of an impression already at 40 that he could be part of the steering committee of the Voloshin yeshiva was no small task. As we know, the Voloshin yeshiva starts to go downhill towards the end of the 19th century because of Russian pressures to be more secular, to include other subjects, things like that. But at least for the time being, that was a prominent position to hold. So much so that while he thought he had made it the big time in the Vardik and then Voloshin, then he makes it to the biggest time. The biggest position in Europe is in Kovno. Kovno was a huge city. And it was at this point where he basically said, this is the top of the ladder in terms of European Jewry. He becomes the chief rabbi of Kovno, effectively the chief rabbi of all Russian Jewry. From this place, he gets there when he's 46 in 1864, and he ends up staying there for the next 32 years until he dies in 1896. As the de facto leader of Russian Jewry, and this is going to get into really who he was all about, Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Spector never backed down from taking on some kind of, advisory or even adversarial role if it meant defending the Jewish people. Kovno was a big town, and people looked at him as being the Rav of that big town. They had already looked at him as being a big posek in Russia because he was the Rav of Novardik, and he had proven himself many times over. But at this point, now he's the Rav of Kovno, and he's, you know, inundated with questions of all kinds, whether local or international. As I said before, he looked back at Novardik as simpler times when he wrote to the Aruch HaShulchan. But now he's in Kovno, and he's basically always, you know, involved in something. So much so, and I don't have a picture of him to show you, but so much so that he was actually very involved with the Tsar of Russia. He would actually, he had his audience with him, and he would speak to him often, not often, although they weren't best friends or anything like that, but he did not look like the type of person that would be best friends with the Tsar of Russia. There's a story I read about him being on a train once, and one of the maskilim, one of the enlightened folk, right? Those who are, you know, who sort of looked at Judaism in a more academic way, and oftentimes were seen as a threat to Judaism, to Orthodox Judaism, I should say. So this maskil had heard that he was on his way to Kovno or somewhere, and he had heard that that Rav Yitzchak was on the train. So he figured, oh, the Gadol Ador is on the train. He must be in first class. So the maskil goes up to first class, and he's looking around, doesn't see anybody. He asks the conductor or the steward or whatever was on the train and says, hey, where's Rav Yitzchak Chanon Spector? I figured he'd be here on the train. He's going to the place where I'm going. So they say, nope, he's not here, sorry. So he goes back to the coach or whatever. He says, nope, not here, sorry. So he goes all the way back to the back of the train, and he asks around to the third class, and they say, you know, do you know where Rav Yitzchak Chanon Spector is? So, oh yeah, he's right over there. He's sitting there davening with his talismans filling on. And he had this long white beard, not really a very well kept. There it is. Good. This is Rav Yitzchak Chanon Spector. Those on Zoom, you can look him up yourself. He looks like, you know, a Hamish Rav. You know, he doesn't look like he didn't look like Rav Shemesh Rav Fall Hirsch, although they were friends. He looked like a Hamish guy, you know, big white beard, not exactly well-trimmed or anything like that. So the maskil goes over to Rav Yitzchak Chanon Spector, and he says to him, really, I expected you to have a more, you know, you have the audience of the Tsar. I expected you to really, you know, be a well-kept type of person, some enlightened to some extent, you know, someone like a modern Jew. That's what he says to Rav Yitzchak Chanon. And Rav Yitzchak Chanon Spector says, yeah, I am a modern Jew. You're the old Jew. So the maskil is like, what are you talking about? This is a little harsh, so I apologize in advance. But this is how the story goes. This is what I read. I saw it in a book, so it must be true. But actually, I saw it on the internet, so you know it's definitely true. So the maskil says, what are you talking about? I'm a modern Jew. He says, I'm not a modern Jew, I'm an old Jew, and you're the modern Jew. So, look at me, I'm clean-shaven, I dressed well, you're not, you know. So he says, you know, we read in the Haggadah, you know, Arami Ovid Avi, right? And we say that, Ovdi Avodah Zarah Hayu Avosenu, right? Those, our forefathers were idol worshippers. So says Rav Yitzchak Chanon Spector, there you go, you're the old Jew. Because you're idol worshippers. That's what he was saying, but it's a little harsh. Either way, so that's sort of his affect towards the masculine. That was the affect of many, that was the attitude of many gedolim of the day. That was the sort of... maybe it was the Novardic influence. But that was the attitude towards all masculine at that point. The masculine were on sort of like an enterprise or a pursuit of changing Judaism. And the rabbis did not take that lightly. All the people of the 19th century, I consider many times the 19th century to be sort of like the golden age of rabbinic Judaism. You think about the people that came out of the 19th century, Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Chassam Sofer, Shem Shalom Fol Hirsch, right, all these huge names that we know of. It could also be because we have better documentation of those times, whatever. But they were all in unison, opposed to the masculine in very harsh ways, right? Many of the people I just named, their entire life was a response to the masculine movement, right? We talked about Volozhin. Volozhin was in many ways an academic response to the masculine. You don't have to be serious about learning in that way. You can be serious about learning in other ways, in traditional ways. So either way, so he was very harsh to the masculine also. Although there's a nuance coming soon, which will be very enlightening also. Pun not intended there, masculine enlightenment. Fine. He was the head of the Russian Jewry, and I said before that he was actually very influential for Agunas. He actually dealt with a couple of situations of Agunas, and the stories, I saw a couple of stories about that also, that there was a case where he was Master Aguna to marry somebody else, and then, or he was Machmer about the Aguna, and then the next day they found the body of the husband to confirm that she could remarry, something like that. That once he got involved, it became confirmed one way or another that the woman could remarry. But he was influential in some of those situations, which were heavy, heavy, you know, questions. And then certainly there were times where Russian Jewry had those situations, not because of some kind of fluke, but because of pogroms. Especially in 1881, there was a set of riots that happened against the Russian Jewry. And he would go to St. Petersburg to talk to the Tsar and to talk, you know, and try to sort of figure out the situation. There was an interesting, I don't know to what extent it was explicit or as generic, interesting discussion that went on amongst the Jews in Russia about whether or not they should try to stay in Russia, make it work, or whether they should get out of there, get out of Dodge, right? You figure out a better way for their survival because they were facing all this persecution. At first, Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector was very much in line with, let's make it work. It'll be better. We can sort of work with the government and work things out. But after time, you eventually realize it's not going to work. It's not going to happen. Things have been, you know, bad for too long. He himself had, as we said before, had to leave a few different towns when he was younger, for one reason or another, possibly because of the that controversy, those anti-Semitism of one kind or another. And this perhaps, I saw this, you see things, you know, written in different ways. According to one source that I saw, this is what also led him to be somewhat supportive of the movement called Chovevei Tzion. Chovevei Tzion was one of the early Zionist movements for religious Jews. And it was headed by religious, you know, real religious poskim. You know, I said before the Yeshuv HaYashan, Reb Shmuel Salanter, also Reb Shmuel Mahalover was a big name in that time. I'm sure I'm forgetting others, but the point is that Chovevei Tzion was, as you can imagine, somewhat controversial. Starting up a settlement in a secular place like Eretz Yisrael, or at that point was called Palestine, much to the chagrin of some people, it was called Palestine. But the point is that he put his support behind Chovevei Tzion. He was not afraid of taking a stand on important issues, and especially even if it meant, you know, weighing in on associations which other people didn't like secular associations. There was actually a society in Russia which was committed to the acculturation of Jewry to Russian culture, right? Acculturation is very different than assimilation. Assimilation means basically becoming Russian Jews, becoming Russian. Acculturation means, you know, the tightrope that we walk. Like Rav Shamshon of Roller Hirsch was trying to promote also at the same time in Germany, in Frankfurt, that you basically have to become, you know, reliable citizens of whatever place you're in, while also keeping halacha to the strictest standards. So he had actually also thrown his support behind this society of some kind, society of acculturation. I don't know, it wasn't called that, but and some people didn't like that because that society was basically run by the masculine. It was run by those who were trying to secularize Judaism. And he had said, at least at the time, in defense of his support, that really he was being supportive of it in the ways that were, you know, in the ways that aligned with halachic Judaism. He wasn't trying to align with it in secular ways. He was trying to align with it to the extent that it was okay in terms of being well-rounded, understanding of the culture. And this is what you ultimately see within his student, Rav Moshe Malfin, who goes to New York City, and creates what ultimately becomes Yeshiva University, in line with his sort of, you know, with his attitude that you have to be in a culture Jew. But this all sort of stems from his willingness to make his own decisions and not follow the party line. So we have Cholov Etzion, we have this member of the acculturation society. And the Cholov Etzion specifically could have been because the Jewish people were struggling in Russia. They were not necessarily going to be, it wasn't going to turn around. Like I said before, he was hoping things would turn around. He would be able to work, smooth things over with the Russian government, talk to the Tsar, you know, make things better. But it never really worked out that way. So ultimately, some say that this is what ultimately led to him being so supportive of Eretz Yisrael, of settling Eretz Yisrael. One of the biggest halachic decisions that he made, certainly in terms of Eretz Yisrael, but if not generally, is something that's often very controversial, especially in this year. But he's sort of, for some reason, he's been, relegated to the back of the issue because Rev Cook basically takes the spotlight for this issue, which is the issue called Heter Mechira. Heter Mechira is the concept, and this is sort of our lessons for today, of the Legends and Lessons. Heter Mechira is a concept that during the Shemitah year where you're not allowed to gain benefit, or at least financial benefit, from produce in Eretz Yisrael, so it's very damaging, as you can imagine, to an economy, especially an economy which is driven by, you know, your produce and the exports, and you know, the whole Eretz Yisrael at the time was basically just farmland, if not desert land, and basically it was just about, you know, creating the commerce through all the produce. So the question was, during a Shemitah year, I believe the year was 1889, all right, so the fall of 1888 or the summer of 1888, and he was asked, what do you believe in terms of Heter Mechira? I believe the question came from, as I said before, of Shmuel Salanter. So he said, look, we don't have a lot of things to make money off of. The economy basically is run through the produce. And therefore, we need some kind of way to keep the economy going. So he was perhaps, they had asked other sort of minor league rabbis before him, and those rabbis basically said, I think Rav Shmuel Mahalover was one of them, where he said, I think the Heter Mechira is okay, but I'm not going to say that it's okay for you to do it unless Rav Yitzchak Yochanan agrees. Right, that's the extent to which he was the Gadol Hador. He didn't live in Eretz Yisrael. He wasn't the Posek of Eretz Yisrael. But if we wanted to settle Eretz Yisrael with a religious flavor, so that the religious Jews will feel comfortable to move here and to really create something, so we need the Haskama, we need the approbation of the Gadol Hador, and that was Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. So Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, at least in 1888, was willing to give his support. I believe I heard that he said that you have to hold. To explain Heter Mechira a little bit better, the isser of benefiting from Eretz Yisrael is for Jews to benefit from Eretz Yisrael because it's an isser. It's an isser in the Torah. However, if a non-Jew wanted to, they could do whatever they wanted. So the concept of Heter Mechira, the allowance of a sale, is basically asking the question: are we allowed to sell to non-Jews? Can we sell the land of Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews? And at least temporarily even. And ultimately, Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector said, yes, you could. I believe originally, to Arabs, I believe he actually did not want them selling to Christians because they might have been Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and that was a whole different thing. But at least to Arabs, and I believe I heard that he said you had to sell for both years, the year of Shemitah and the year after Shemitah, to make sure that no one was benefiting from the produce, you know, that was left over. And it's hard. Different produce, different vegetation is judged at different times, so it gets a little complicated. So he said, do both years, the Shemitah year and the year after the Shemitah year. You have to keep it. You have to keep the Mechira in place. Legend has it that when it came to 1895, which was basically the year before his death, I mean, he's frail, but he's still being asked the Shilas, so then he changed his tune a little bit, but to be more supportive. I believe he was willing to, something along the lines of he was willing to give support the first time around in conjunction with those other rabbanim, those other poskim that had also allowed it. But the second time around, they came to him and he basically says, yes, it's okay, without anyone else's support. He was willing to give his stamp of approval. This was his major psak, especially for the Jews of Eretz Yisrael. It happens to be that Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook comes in the early 20th century and basically, is the one to hold up the psak there. It's unclear if Rav Yitzchak Elchanan would have continued his psak. There is what to be said for the fact that those early settlements in Eretz Yisrael really relied upon the produce, the agriculture. But as you sort of create an economy that can grow independent of the produce, so it's not exactly clear whether he would have given the same sack. I've heard that before, but I'm not sure. It's no way to prove that. But either way, so this was his big sack of Hetzer Mechira. And I believe it came. There were even earlier achronim that had talked about it, but for modern Jewish history, he was really the big posek that gave the stamp of approval for Hetzer Mechira. But ultimately, Rav Cook gets all the credit because Rav Cook was the more controversial one, where the sort of the secular immigration wave to Eretz Yisrael came in, and he still gave the Hetzer Mechira, and he had this whole association with secular Jewry, which was even more controversial. So that probably sort of stirred up more controversy. But Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was the first one to do it. As I said before, one of his students, Rav Moshe Matlin, ultimately starts a cheder for his son in the Lower East Side of Manhattan called Eitz Chaim. And then that ultimately morphs into one thing or another in the 1920s. And I believe, his son grew up a little, got older, and they started a post, I don't know if it was post high school or post cheder, more intensive learning. And this is for the immigrants that were coming over to America that maybe spoke Yiddish that also needed some kind of help with secular studies and language and things like that. And they had this in the yeshiva Eitz Chaim. It was sort of like the first Torah Umada in America model. And when Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector died on the 21st of Adar in 1896, which is a week from tonight, they made a decision as a yeshiva that they're going to call their yeshiva, they're going to call the yeshiva Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector something. Now it's called Rav Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. I'm not sure if that was the exact name back then. It could have just been Yeshiva Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, something like that. Because YU, Yeshiva University, as an entity with the whole curriculum, didn't really exist in a formal sense until the 1920s. At least when they started Yeshiva College, I think it was 1928. The buildings there existed before that also. But they were already sort of like an outgrowth of the Rav Moshe Matlin. But for whatever reason, history goes to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. Even though Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was never in YU, he never was there, but his vision of being a cultured Jew, someone who was aware and involved with the general, even secular society, to the extent that you could, while maintaining your religious convictions. So that attitude was definitely filtered into YU. Whether or not he would still be supportive of YU, to be honest, I'm not sure. To the extent that things are going to go on at YU, would he appreciate some of the more secular studies? I don't know. I couldn't tell you for sure. But certainly he was willing on a personal level to take matters into his own hands when it came to secular things, meeting with the Tsar, we talked about that acculturation society, talked about Chovei Tzion, and we talked about the Shemitah controversy, we talked about Agunas. He was on the brink of all these major issues, and even these very controversial topics. He wasn't afraid of getting sort of in the thick of things. And that's really, I think, the greatest mistora of the Jewish people, sort of the YU world, the Jewish people in the YU world, that our job is to really embrace that which is going on in the world. Sometimes that's controversial, sometimes that's difficult, sometimes you have to put your foot down and be machmir about things, and side with Yiddishkeit, and side with halacha, but that doesn't mean you ignore it. And that's what I think is the greatest sort of legacy as Lefi Anias Daisy, really Anias Daisy, my very poor opinion, it's not worth much, but in terms of the legacy of Yitzchak Elchanan, he was the Gadol Dor, so he doesn't need other kinds of perspective to justify who he was, but in terms of sort of like a kernel of inspiration that we could take from Yitzchak Hanan, he was the type of person that did not shy away from controversy, and he was did not shy away from giving a psak on very fundamental questions. Aguna questions are very difficult to answer. And the Gittin, and as we said before, he has a whole shilas of tshuvas of all these different shilas. But the ones he's known for, Heter Mechira, was very controversial even at the time. Obviously, to be associated with Chovei Tzion was controversial. To be associated with that society of acculturation was controversial. To make the decisions he probably had to make in Volozhin was probably controversial. So he was not someone who shied away from making those major decisions. But he nonetheless was considered to be the Gadol HaDor by most of Jewry. You know, they say that every house in Russia, every Jewish home in Russia had a picture of Yitzchak Hanan. I don't know how it's possible, but that's what they say. At least, you know, symbolically, that's what, you know, people put out pictures of the Gedolim. And he was certainly the Gadol HaDor when he was around, the Rav of Kovna, which we said was very busy for him. But he didn't shy away from trying to fight for the Jewish people until ultimately he supported Chovei Tzion, tried to get people to move to Eretz Yisrael, and he helped them settle with his very interesting shitas on Heter Mechira. And I'm sure there were others that came up, but that are not as well known. I also mentioned that sort of a similar outlook towards Torah Mada. He was very good friends with Rav Sham Shalfal Hirsch, although their friendship was apparently somewhat secretive. I'm not sure why. But either way, that's the legacy of Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector. For those of you who have any association with Yeshiva University, you should know that this is the legacy of the yeshiva, to be, you know, well-rounded Talmidei Chachamim who aren't afraid to embrace secular culture to the extent that it's necessary, and it will help you be a better Jew in the modern world. So as he said to that Jew on the train, that masculine train, he's the modern Jew. Doesn't matter what he looks like, it matters what he does. He was willing to talk to the Tsar, to talk to the most important people in secular society to make sure the Jewish people were protected and to make sure that a life of Torah mitzvot would be possible. Okay. Thank you for coming. You had a question, Srita? Oh, he had a Shalos Tshuvos, I think it was called the Beis Yitzchak. Shalos Tshuvos Beis Yitzchak. And I believe he had another, I don't remember what it was. Nachal Yitzchak, but I don't remember if it was a halakhic sefer or if it was like a commentary sefer. I don't remember. So that was his successor in Nevardik. The Aruch HaShulchan had the commentary. That was his successor in Nevardik. He might have written the Nachal Yitzchak in Nevardik. I don't know. So I don't know exactly, but the Shalos Tshuvos was throughout his life. And Yeshiva University until today has they come out, I don't know if it's yearly or it used to be yearly, they come out with a Torah journal. It's not a journal, it's like a thick book called the Beis Yitzchak, where they talk about sort of like all these sugyos and different topics and things like that. What? Yeah, it used to be annually. I don't remember it being like published or hearing about it when I was in NYU, so I don't know if they still do it annually, but either way, it's written by the students and it's the whole thing, but it's named after the Beis Yitzchak of Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector. Okay, shukar to everyone for coming now, and everyone, whenever someone tells you about Reitz or YU, you know what the namesake is all about, and hopefully you can understand sort of the underpinnings of the Hashkafa at YU. Okay, everyone should have a good night and stay warm.